Hey everyone, this amazing ESO Network show is brought to you by our fine sponsor, Amazon.com. Please remember to shop Amazon for all your geeky needs, no matter what time of the year it is. All you need to do is go to ESOpodcast.com/ESOAmazon or click on the Amazon banner on the ESO Network webpage to go to our e-store. It's the best way to shop and the best way to support this program, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. Okay, that's enough of me babbling for now. Now on with your regular scheduled show.
Welcome to Earth Station 1, a weekly podcast dedicated to all things sci-fi, fantasy, and much, much more. Sit back and relax and enjoy the show.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Earth Station 1 podcast. That's right, folks, we are back again, and we went to another con. Shocker, it's con season. Of course we're there. And we went to the amazing Toylanta Con, formerly known as Jolanta, last weekend, and we had a blast. And, you know, me walking out with just two bags of pop figures, you know, that's pretty good for me. So, so it was a great time, and we actually did a panel there on Mego figures, the classic pop figures before there were any. They basically were the it toys of the 1970s, pretty much. Basically from 1970 till about 1980 into the early 80s, all the action figures you saw at the time, other than Star Wars, were Mego figures. And we talked all about it in front of a live studio audience, and we had some great input from the crowd. So it was a great show. And speaking of great showmanship, I have my fabulous co-host there this week. Let's welcome Mr. Mike Gordon.
Howdy.
How are you, my friend?
I'm great, man. I mean, last weekend was outstanding. It was so much fun being part of Toylanta. You know, even just as a fan going and looking around at the dealer room, as well as all the custom figures and, of course, the musical acts that play there and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, to get to do a panel is really outstanding, to be part of the convention. And to, you know, later on, we're going to talk about Migos, which is they were the big game changers of certainly boys toys and even just toys in general in the 1970s. So it's really cool to be talking about that.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And we have some great people to talk to. I mean, on the panel was our good friends Ricky Zero, as well as Buddy Finnethy, who we had on a couple weeks ago. Great guys.
Oh, I do understand. And probably, you know, these guys were buckets of knowledge. They were like what I knew probably could only be in their little pinky, how much stuff they knew. It was pretty amazing. And both Mike and I were just in awe on how much the audience even knew. It's great. You guys are in for a treat tonight.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But that's not all. We also have our sometimes co-host, Lacey, was at a con last weekend out in Huntsville, Alabama. And she basically is coming on the show to talk all about it, her experiences of meeting Joey Fatone. It's pretty awesome. Oh, wait, she did other things at the con too, but that's mostly what I've seen her pictures of.
I know, right?
So she's going to be coming about on the show to talk all about that. And we also have an old friend of the show, Jennifer Weiss, is going to take a shot at the geek seat. So
now, has she just been locked away in a compartment on the station somewhere for all these years?
She's from Canada, so I think they finally let her over the border up to the teleporter.
Okay, I didn't know if, you know, so we had smuggled someone else aboard for a while. So, you know, I know that JD still wanders the halls, although I don't see him around nearly as much as I should. Look at this level of dust here. But, you know, I didn't know if they're, you know, this station's really big. And I don't know if people get that feeling when they're, you know, when they come on, because they come on and the guests, they see our main bridge console type place. And then we've got the area with the geek seat, which is getting the smell a little bit, to be honest with you.
Dude, I think that smell is JD, but that's a different story.
Yeah, that could be. So I just didn't know if she just, you know, was hiding all this time at a different part of the station, or if she, you know, was just resuming her life ESO free.
I thought she was trying to go into rehab from us, or was it the witness protection program? She had a thing for David Lee Roth, if I remember correctly.
Oh, well then. Okay. I could see where she'd need, some mental health issues.
Exactly. So speaking of mental health issues, we want to hear from you at home. Please write us esopodcast@gmail.com or call us at 404-963-9057. All right, let's get started with this week's Rants and Raves, where we find about what's on our minds. We've actually had a pretty downer of a week, you know, with some pretty big names.
We lost two, and I'm you know, I'm not throwing around this word lightly here. Legends. Their influence is phenomenal in both of the areas that they were in, and we lost them both this year. And first one was, as many people know, because this one made all the headlines, was Chuck Berry. I can't even imagine that there's anybody out there that doesn't know who Chuck Berry is. If for nothing else, he was referenced in Back to the Future. So that should give you a clue as how big he was. But it can be argued in certain circles that we would not have rock and roll if it wasn't for Chuck Berry.
Chuck Berry was a true innovator and, you know,
pioneer. Like,
he was a pioneer. You know, one of his biggest songs, Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll.
Yeah. I mean, songs that we take for granted, like rock and roll music, Johnny B. Goode, Roll Over Beethoven, Maybelline, the list goes on and on and on. Things that we just think, you know, are just there. He created his guitar work. Second to none, outstanding, not just in the 50s and 60s when it like was unheard of to sound like that, but even later on, you know, when I remember there was a concert that Keith Richards put together to celebrate Chuck Berry back in the 80s. And man, Chuck still could outplay Keith Richards at that time. I mean, outstanding. We can state like all the facts, like all the albums and all the stuff that he did. But to be honest, you know, you can read that in books, many, many books, documentaries, Wikipedia, whatnot. But for me, what's interesting is that, to be honest, I'll say this right off the bat, probably throughout most of my youth. And I took him for granted because I just heard the songs, but I never really realized that somebody was behind them, so to speak, as you do when you're younger. But I got to say that when I was studying abroad in the 80s, in the late 80s, I was over in London. And occasionally, even though London is awesome, and I definitely encourage anybody that wants to go to London to go to London because it's really awesome. But occasionally, since I was there for a few months, I got homesick. And one time I bought I was out at one of the flea markets, and some guy was selling cassettes, and he had a Chuck Berry cassette of Greatest Hits. It was legit. It wasn't illegal cassette or anything like that, but it was a collection of his big hits between 1955 and 1965. And I would pop that cassette in. I bought it. I would pop that cassette in my Walkman occasionally, and right away, I just felt like I was home. There's something so delightfully American about Chuck Berry, and it just moves you. I mean, it's just like when you hear his songs, you can't help but move your feet. You can't help but smile, have a smile on your face. And you know, it's funny that he inspired me. Over in England, because so many artists, other legendary artists like Dave Davies and Ray Davies of the Kinks, Paul McCartney and John Lennon of the Beatles, all of the Rolling Stones, Keith Richards included, were influenced by Chuck Berry. So Chuck Berry's sound, when it hit England, was responsible for inspiring many of the people who would come back to the States and be part of the British invasion. So it's amazing to see all the connections there. But, you know, he's a true legend. I mean, I don't think it gets any bigger than Chuck Berry.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. No, even for me growing up, You know, of course, you know, you heard him, his version of Maybelline, you know, Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll, and, you know, many others. But the big one when I was growing up was My Ding-a-Ling.
Oh, right. Yes, yes.
You know, yeah, which had many meanings to it.
Sure. But yeah, that was one of those Dr. Demento-esque type songs.
Well, exactly. But it was awesome because to a little kid, it was bells. But to an older person, it was, you know, another instrument, you could say.
You know, I'm sure that didn't even occur to him when he wrote that song. I'm sure he had no clue that that would happen.
Oh, yeah. Not at all. And he was just such a great performer. I've seen him twice in concert.
Nice.
And back 80s, it had to be.
Yeah.
Yes, so exactly.
Yeah, that's incredible. Incredible. So I definitely encourage people to go out. If you don't know who Chuck Berry is, go listen to, pull up iTunes, pull up whatever, pull up Amazon, pull up YouTube and listen to some songs. And I guarantee you, you'll be like, oh, okay, that's where all that came from, because that's where a lot of it came from, was him. So, but we have to mention now, we lost also, unfortunately, and this was after, it wasn't really a surprise, because unfortunately, illustrator Bernie Wrightson has been sick for quite some time, dealing with a lot of health issues. So he had recently, I think a couple months ago, announced that he was retiring from illustrating, which was sad in and of itself. But now we found out this weekend that he passed on. And it didn't make the headlines like Chuck Berry did, but I would argue that in some ways Bernie Wrightson was just as influential in what he did in terms of especially his horror comics and illustrations as Chuck Berry was to rock and roll. You will be hard pressed to find somebody out there who is a horror fan, particularly of horror comics, that has not heard of or is not a worshiper of Bernie Wrightson. He co-created Swamp Thing. And so that is in and of itself is sort of cements his legend. In the 70s, he worked with an artist studio with many, many, many other great artists like Barry Windsor Smith, Jeffrey Jones, Michael Kaluta. And these guys were like, I mean, these guys, as far as illustration goes, they were like the Beatles or the Stones of the time. I mean, this was like four of the most influential illustrator artists out there. And people are still like learning from their work and still copying them to this day. They worked on Bernie worked on a lot of horror comics back in the day, back in his early days, but like I said, he continued to work in DC. I probably know him and connect with him more from some of his work later on with Batman. He did a series with Jim Starling called, a miniseries called The Cult, which is still one of my favorite Batman miniseries of all time. I also a big fan, as many people know here, of the movie Heavy Metal. And there's a segment in Heavy Metal with Captain Stern. Captain Stern was a character that Wrightson created for Heavy Metal magazine, and the look of Captain Stern and all that. That story that's in the movie was based on a cartoon of his. Later on, he created a miniseries for Captain Stern, which was quite amusing. But he did a lot of work on the regular heroes. Like, he did a Spider-Man graphic novel. He's done some Superman and Batman work, as well as Hulk and The Thing. He's done a lot. Most recently, he's worked with Steve Niles on a Frankenstein graphic novel, which, my God, it's one of the most beautifully illustrated things I've ever seen. I don't have a copy of it yet, but it is on my bucket list to get. It is just amazing. So a lot of people out there, certainly in our circles, who are comic fans, who are fans of art, who are fans of horror, are definitely mourning the loss of Bernie Wrightson. I've met him twice, and I can say that, you know, as talented as he is, He's absolutely a sweetheart, and he was absolutely just a gentleman, classy, nice guy. And that makes it even worse because, you just hate to see lose guys like that.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. And, you know, for me, you know, his work, anytime you saw it, it was all gothic feel, all very dark. And it was just beautiful to see, you know, his Swamp Thing, his Frankenstein, and it's just everything you heard about him, you know, the art books, the posters, it's just amazing to think about. And we are going to be doing an episode in honor of him.
Yeah, we were going to do that. And by the way, we were going to do that anyway later on this year, but we bumped it up to next month.
Yeah, it'll be early April sometime that we'll be doing it. And we've already arranged for Mark Maddox to join us because he's not going to stop talking about it until we let him on the show.
and anybody on our show who knows Mark knows that he'll live up to that promise. He will not stop talking.
Exactly.
It's definitely worth it. I would say that if you have never heard of Bernie Wrightson, if you are not familiar with him, Google images Bernie Wrightson, and you will see some compelling images that will amaze you. His illustration, I almost feel like I hate to be that old guy that says, they just don't make them like that anymore. But damn it. I mean, they don't make a lot of them like Bernie Wrightson, period.
Very true. There will never be another one. And that's a loss for us all. So that is going to wrap up our Rants and Raves segment. So let's take a quick break and we'll be back in a moment. After, of course, Ashley's movie reviews, we'll be back with the Geek Seat.
It was a teenage wedding and the old folks wished them well. You could see that Pierre did truly love the mademoiselle. And now the young monsieur and madame have rung the chapel bell. C'est la vie, said the old folks, it goes to show you never can tell.
They furnished off an... Hi, this is Ashley Pauls with this week's What to Watch. We are now deep in the middle of March Madness. If you're feeling depressed that your bracket's already busted or your favorite basketball team's been kicked out of the tournament, never fear. We've got some new movies coming out in theaters this weekend to distract you. Let's go ahead and dive on in and see if any of these are going to be worth your time. I'm not really expecting any of these to challenge Beauty and the Beast, which had a huge 170 million debut this week and is probably going to take the number one spot this weekend. Its biggest challenger, or at least would-be challenger, is the Power Rangers movie. This is billing itself as a gritty reimagining of the favorite 1990s show. However, we don't have any reviews yet, and I'm just getting a flop vibe from this one, unfortunately. I don't know if nostalgia is going to be enough to carry it over the finish line, but I guess we'll just have to wait and see. Next up, we've got the sci-fi horror thriller Life. It's about the crew on board the International Space Station. They find alien life on Mars and bring a sample back to the station to study. Inevitably, this sample turns out to be very hostile and threatens the lives not only of the crew members, but of the entire safety of the Earth. I'm getting vibes from this one, kind of based on some movies I've seen before, like Alien and the Martian, but it's actually getting decent advanced reviews, so this one could be worth checking out on the big screen. Finally, we've got Chips, which is a reboot of the classic Buddy Cop TV series. I'm not really expecting a lot out of this action comedy. This one, unfortunately, kind of has a flop vibe as well, but we'll have to wait and see what happens. If none of those movies are to your liking, we've got a couple coming out on DVD. We have the animated musical Sing, which is a movie about a bunch of animals who, unsurprisingly, want to sing. This is a fairly harmless, fun family flick. We've also got Assassin's Creed, which is an adaptation of the video game starring Michael Fassbender. This one didn't do a whole lot at the box office when it was released last year and wasn't exactly celebrated by critics, but it might be worth a couple bucks to rent at home. Well, that's it for this week. Be sure to tune in next week when we're going to be talking about Ghost in the Shell.
And now the young monsieur and madame have rung the chapel bell. C'est la vie, c'est the old folks. It goes to show you never can tell.
Welcome back. Now it's time for the Geek Seat segment. And we have actually somebody who used to be very much a part of the Earth Station 1 podcast years and years ago. And also she used to write for our wonderful website. So let's welcome back to the show, Jennifer Weiss. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Howdy. Welcome back to the station. We've had some renovations, I think, since you were last on board. So it might look
a little different. I can tell it looks really different.
Yeah, it looks probably a lot dirtier. Yeah. Well, the cleaning crew just is not, JD is just not coming around as often as he used to. Well, for those people who might not be familiar with you, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I live in Canada. The last time I was on the podcast, I was living in Thailand. Wow. I've studied religious studies, and now I work for a telecommunications company.
Awesome. And what kind of geeky stuff do you like? What kind of, like, do you have a passion of any kind of genre or medium?
Mostly I'm science fiction, movies, and TV. But I have been known to freak out over Van Halen for a very long time. Finally, that passed.
Oh, you're gotcha. Not going to be Mr. David Lee Roth anymore?
David Lee Roth? Well, I'm still hoping, but not so far.
He's a hard one to tie down, that Lee Roth.
Well, I have watched his YouTube videos. I know he's living in Japan right now. I'm like, I could go. No, I won't go. That would be weird.
That would be weird, I guess. I mean, that's what it's there for, though, right?
Yes, but I'm not a stalker. I just want someone to introduce me.
Gotcha. Okay. Well,
Like, isn't that so, how it started with you and Elijah Dushku?
No, see, we're just moving on. Okay. From here. So we're just moving on. What kind of sci-fi are you in? Books, movies, you said, TV?
Yeah, when I was younger, I read a lot of books. And then when I went to university, I didn't read so much fiction. Most of my fiction is television and movies. And I would probably say that Star Trek and Star Wars are the big ones. When I was a kid and I was reading books, it was Dune, Arthur C. Clarke, Ringworld, stuff like that. But in terms of movies and TV now, it's mostly Star Trek, Star Wars, whatever comic book movie is on, that kind of thing.
Gotcha. Is there anything right now that's either coming out or just came out that you're really excited about?
Well, I've been watching The Man in the High Castle.
Okay.
It's one of those alternate reality things going on. It's on Amazon. And I found that really interesting because every episode you're kind of like, what's going on? Is this guy a good guy or a bad guy? And then I was talking to a friend of mine at work who'd seen it, and I said, I'm kind of curious about the girl because it's based on a Philip K. Dick book, and Philip K. Dick books, the girl is always different than what you think. And he was like, wait till the second season. And I was like, ah, damn it.
So you kind of knew that was coming, though, anyway.
Yeah. Philip K. Dick wrote the and Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep that Blade Runner is based on.
Yep.
And there was Imposter, which was a pretty good movie with Gary Sinise that nobody ever saw. And so he has a pretty standard theme of what happens. Basically, the main character, the male character and the female character are never what you think. And they don't even know it necessarily.
Yeah. And I'm a big Blade Runner fan myself. So, and I have read a little bit of Philip K. Dick, not tremendous amount, but just,
We can be friends then.
Oh, okay. Awesome. Awesome. Anything else that you're really excited by that's going on right now? Anything as far as movies that you're looking forward to this year?
I did go and see Logan for the second time, but
twice. So you must have enjoyed it.
I did. And I wanted to write something about it. So I wanted to go and see it a second time because the first time I was just so wound up with it. I am looking forward to the new Blade Runner movie. I'm not sure if that's coming out this year,
but
based on the cluster F that was Prometheus, I'm terrified. So,
well, we do know that Ridley's not personally directing the second Blade Runner movie. So there's that.
That might be good then. Yeah.
That might be good. I did see a trailer for it, I think, before Logan, actually. And I think I thought, wow, it looks a lot better than I thought it was going to look.
The trailer for Prometheus was really good, too.
That's true. So yeah,
I wrote a review of that, and Mike said, I feel like I just watched you walk up to Ridley Scott in a restaurant and slap him.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, I was so annoyed.
So I understand that you have your own blog.
I do.
And that you have a presence online. What kind of topics do you cover on your blog? Just anything or?
Yeah, pretty much anything. I was sort of trying to find a theme, but then I was looking at some writers that I like online and they don't really have a theme. They just sort of write about things that come up. Right now I'm writing something about how a little bit of knowledge can be a dangerous thing. I was talking to my cousin, and I mean, we're in Canada, so we're not directly affected by what's going on down there with the politics. But we were talking about how I was thinking about Twitter and how there's a little bit of information and people get stuff and they retweet things and they have a little bit of information about things. And during the Protestant Reformation, part of it that kicked it all off was the availability of the Bible in languages that were not Latin. And one of the reasons that the Catholic Church didn't like that, apart from the obvious reasons of we won't control all the information, is that people would be reading them in their own languages and interpreting things literally, where the Catholic Church, say what you want to say about it, does not necessarily and didn't ever necessarily interpret everything in the Bible literally. And without having a Catholic priest there to interpret things for you, you might go in a direction that they might not necessarily want you to go. And I'm not saying that the Catholic Church never made their mistakes. God knows they made their mistakes. But that was part of the problem that they had with the Bible, was you get a little bit of reading, you read it, and you're like, well, it says this in the Bible. And all of a sudden you've got, well, if English was good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for me.
Ooh,
Think about, yeah, so, and this stuff with Twitter and all of the little bits of information that people have and regurgitating it over and over and over again, it just sort of reminded me of that.
Wow. So then, and that's the, so you cover, it sounds like you cover a huge range of things on your blog.
I do. Yeah. And awesome. I did the first thing that I wrote that I actually put on another blog and decided, no, I'm just going to move everything together. Just going back to the David Lee Roth thing, was a 3,200 word essay on Van Halen and David Lee Roth when they got back together with him in 2007. I lost my mind. I don't think that I had ever
been. So did David. No, just kidding.
Well, I it was weird because I don't think I had ever been as passionate about anything as I was about them getting back together with him. And I didn't even feel it at the time. It was only like I got the tickets and I went and I thought, oh, this will be great nostalgia, because I hadn't been able to go when I was younger, because because it was rush seating when they came to town, and in the 70s, some people were killed in a rush seating incident, so my mom wouldn't let me go. So I was like, okay, well, I'll get to go. In 1984, I couldn't go. That was when she wouldn't let me go. And I thought, well, I'll see them next time. And of course, they broke up and they got together with Sammy Hagar. And I did see them with Sammy Hagar in the 90s because I got free tickets from the bar that I worked at, and I didn't really care. And then when they got back together with Dave, I went to the show, and then a friend of mine got tickets in Chicago, and I was like, can I come and see them in Chicago with you? And he's like, yes. And it was really all I could do to bring myself to talk about anything else. I looked at all 90 pages of the Google searches. I still have Google alerts for both of them. And I wrote this huge essay about it. It was started out as like 2,700 words. And I was like, oh, this has to be shorter. It ended up being 32. It was probably the single best thing I've ever written, I gotta say.
Wow. Okay. Well, people can check that out, and we will have a link to your blog on our show notes, so people can just click on that and check it out. And nice. Now And I understand also, are you a member of the, like, the convention scene up there in Canada?
I do. I volunteer at the Calgary Comic and Entertainment Expo. And I've also done in Edmonton this year. Between Calgary and Edmonton, it'll be my 10th year.
Wow. So congratulations on that. That's pretty outstanding.
Thanks. It's pretty nice. So, we get a lot of people, and it's not very expensive, this one. Our show is not super expensive. It's very affordable, but it sells out pretty fast every year.
Oh, yeah? Is it a big show? Is it held at a convention center? Or?
Yeah. The one in Calgary, it's at the Stampede Grounds. The bulk of it is in the BMO Center, Bank of Montreal building. It's quite a large area. There's five halls with it. And normally, if anybody has a show in there, they don't use all five halls. We use all five halls. There's also another building. They basically use all the buildings at the Stampede Grounds. So if anybody goes to calgarystampede.com and looks at it, they'll see that it's all there, which is normally great, but it's a big area and it's not all connected. So when there's poor weather, it's not the best thing. And it's held the last weekend in April. But if you've ever been to Calgary or you know anything about Calgary, there's no guarantee that there won't be snow even in July. When I was six, it snowed once every month. Not a lot, but it snowed once every month. And wow. A few years ago, there was some snow. And if it was nice, nobody would have minded, but they come in their costumes and everything, and people would get upset because they had to walk from the ticket place to where the convention was, and they had to do it outside, and there was like a centimeter of quarter inch of snow on the bottom on the ground for people to walk through. So it wasn't the best one, but it's quite a large area. There's a lot of space. The one in Edmonton is also held at a convention center, or it's near the hockey arena, I think. And it also has a whole bunch of halls that can all be linked together, but they're all indoors. So in that way, that one is a little bit better in terms of getting around once you get inside. But they're both quite pretty large, I think, for a Canadian show.
Excellent. Well, we'll definitely check that out. We'll have a link to that show as well on our show notes, so people can check that out if they're interested in going up there and seeing the convention. So, but right now, last time you were here, we did not have the geek seat. So I think that's something that you should experience.
Okay,
Mr. I'm Mike, ready. Tie her down.
Yes, I have been working on that as we've been talking, and I believe she is secure.
Excellent. You've gotten very stealth with that, sir.
Well, you know, you do this for what it's been, 6 years, 7 years?
Yeah, long enough.
Crazy, right?
I know. Crazy stuff. All right, Jennifer, are you ready for your first question in the geek seat?
I am.
What is your favorite geek out moment?
Well, apart from the whole David Lee Roth freak out, in the 90s, I was living in Toronto, and there were always movies and TV shows being filmed there. And there was one being filmed near my house. And if you're a reasonably attractive girl of a youngish age, which I was in the 90s, someone is going to come up to you and say, "Hey, baby, I work on the show." So this guy comes up to me and he's talking to me. And I said, "You know, what is going on here?" And it was a show called, I think it was called Hoop Dreams or Hoop Life. I can't remember what it was. And Avery Brooks was directing it, the captain of Deep Space Nine.
Oh, awesome.
And he was my favorite captain. All the blood drained from my face. And I was like, "Oh, do you think I could talk to him?" And they're like, "You know, we're really kind of far behind." And I said, "Oh, is he cranky?" And they're like, "Yeah, kind of." And I said, "Well, I'm still going to try." And the guy just kind of backed away from me. He's like, "Okay, I'm going over here now." And I waited in the cold for about 2 hours for stuff to wrap up. And then he sort of started packing stuff up, and he came over near me, and he's tall. He's like 6'3" easy. And I think that most people didn't realize that because the women on that show were so tall, 5'10", 6 feet in boots. So he doesn't look like he's really tall because the women are really tall. Anyway, so I go up to him and I say, "Mr. Brooks?" And he gets this different tone of voice because while he was directing, he was all swagger. And you could tell he was kind of like, "I hear a Star Trek fan." And I went up to him and said, "Mr. Brooks?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "You're my favorite captain." And he got this big grin on his face. And then I rattled on about, I can't even remember. I told him that I had a Starfleet Academy graduation ring. And his eyes kind of got wide like, "Oh my God, what am I in for here?" And I stuck out my hand and I shook his hand. And he seemed a little reluctant at first. And then I walked away. And it was weird because I had been totally calm for the 2 hours leading up to it. And then I spoke to him for about 45 seconds. And if it had gone on any longer, I probably would have squealed. It was mortifying,
oh, that
but
is
still awesome at the same time.
That is cool. But what was your most disappointing geek out moment?
Well, this is kind of disappointing, but actually it was kind of exhilarating at the same time. I was blocked by Adam Baldwin on Twitter.
Oh, really? Why?
Yeah.
Probably something political.
Yeah. I was asking questions. This is when I don't know if he's still active now. I mean, I'm sure he is because even if you're blocked on Twitter, if you log out and you go and you look through Twitter, you can still see everything that everybody's saying. You just can't interact with them. But this was, I don't even know how long ago this was, 4 or 5 years ago. I was legit just asking him questions about why he felt certain ways. And he started out being kind of cranky, and I was like, "No, man, I really just want to know what you're saying." And his response tended to be basically, "Read everything I've ever read and then come back to me and tell me that you still disagree with me." He wouldn't answer a question, and I can't remember what the question was, the final question that I asked, but then all of a sudden I couldn't communicate with him anymore. He had blocked me, and then one or two of his minions started hassling me, and I just ignored them and it all went away. But I was like, he's a right-wing gun nut.
He is.
I like him. Yeah, I like him on his shows and stuff, but I was like, how did Joss Whedon ever make friends with this guy?
Good point. What geeks you out the most?
I really enjoy having animated discussions about almost anything with someone who's well-informed. Either more well-informed or as well-informed as I am, even if we don't agree about it. I really enjoy being able to have those kinds of conversations. I don't tend to have too many of those around anymore.
Oh, I could totally understand that. Sometimes it's, if you don't find somebody challenging that you want to talk to, you always go, "Okay, got to get going."
Yep.
What turns your geek off?
The opposite. Basically having someone who, you know, like you said, you can't really have a conversation with them. And you're like, "Well, you know what? I'm kind of done here. I'm just going to do something else."
Okay.
No longer interested in having this conversation. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And you usually find it out fairly quickly. And it's most of the time very disappointing.
Yes.
What fictional character would you like to meet the most?
Well, I was kind of back and forth on this. My first thought, of course, was Han Solo. And then because I'd watched Logan, I thought Wolverine, but I'm not sure he'd be very good dinner conversation. So I thought about Michael Fassbender's Magneto, specifically the Michael Fassbender version. He's so much more intense, so charismatic, so smart. And I've always liked Magneto because he's doing the wrong things for the right reasons. He's like the epitome of anti-hero. And as I looked more at the X-Men and thinking about when it started to be written as a comic, I remember thinking, I don't understand how at the time young Jewish men in the 50s and 60s thought that Xavier is the good guy. Like, how did they not side with Magneto? And I suppose that's partly why he's such an interesting character. So he would be someone that you'd have a lot to talk about, especially with the, you know, being younger and going, getting old, getting younger. He's got a really long timeline. He'd have a lot of stuff to talk about.
Mm-hmm. true. What fictional character do you like to meet the least?
Well, I kind of tend towards people like Emperor Palpatine, just because it's a good idea to stay away from megalomaniac fascists. You just don't want to be on their radar.
That's why we don't talk politics on this show. What is your favorite geek word, phrase, quote, or pose?
It's from one of the Star Trek movies. Sadly, I can't remember which one it was. It was the one where they were going to make peace with the Klingons. So one of the even-numbered ones, because it was one of the good ones.
Six.
And
it's six.
Yeah. Okay, good. And Spock goes to Kirk and says, you know, we want you to be the person who goes to the Klingons. And of course, he doesn't want to do it because the Klingons killed his son. And Spock says, you know, they're dying. And Kirk says, let them die. And Spock's response is, you know, there's an old saying on Vulcan, only Nixon could go to China. And it was like, only the person that you expect doesn't want to find what you're looking for. If they can make that kind of peace, then you know the peace will last. So it isn't necessarily, you don't necessarily want to go with the person you think is the most qualified, but maybe somebody who brings something else to the table. So I've always loved that expression. I had a t-shirt made with it. For a while I started a Facebook group with it, but it kind of petered out. I've always loved that expression.
I remember that group. What is your ideal geek occupation?
Well, I really like to travel, and I don't think that it would just be something that would be, like, if we're going to go sort of science fiction-y, not just travel in place, but in time, an explorer of any type, going back in time to see what really happened, or going forward in time to see where we're going. And also, this is sort of a secondary one, but it could probably be fit in with all of this. I've always wanted to be an assassin. I don't know why. Like James Bond. It was the first thing I wanted to do when I was a kid. Wanted to be an assassin. But let's just say a space assassin, because this is going on the internet.
Remember, don't get on her bad side, folks. And if David Lee Roth is listening, please call the young lady, or she'll come after you. What is your geek occupation would you not like to do?
Really anything that would involve garbage collection. So, I mean, if you're thinking just sort of like regular alleys kinds of things, then that wouldn't work. But if you're thinking Guardians of the Galaxy, all of that sort of stuff, somebody still has to collect the garbage. I don't want to do it.
Yeah, especially out there. You never know what left it.
That comes up.
Rubber gloves will not be enough.
A lot more often than I would have thought.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jennifer, are you ready for your final question in the geek seat?
Mm-hmm.
All right. And remember, we are a family friendly show. So what is your ultimate geek fantasy?
Well, I'd love to just sort of to bring it back from the science fictioniness. I would love to travel and write about it, get paid enough to pay my debts, save for retirement. I'm not really that fussy. Maybe I'd like to write a book that gets made into a movie and have Michael Fassbender play me in the film. But mostly I just want to enjoy what I'm doing and do what I enjoy and be able to retire effectively with whatever money I make from it.
That is a great answer. Awesome.
Thanks.
Well, Jennifer, you have made it through the geek seat. Congratulations. Yay. Mr. Mike Gordon, tell the young lady what she's won.
You have won a lifetime subscription, a value easily worth $16.04.
Is that Canadian?
Nice.
Yeah, well, it's, yeah, maybe. No,
so that's
Canadian
like is $20 US.
Yeah, there you go. That makes sense. But it's only good on the station. Like, is the further you get, like, back down towards Earth, then it really devalues.
All right. Good to know.
Exactly. So. It's like going to Disney. You know, you can only use some of their money at the park, but anywhere else.
Exactly. No.
Right.
Well, Jen, thank you so much for joining us. How can people find you? Do you have your blog?
I do. My blog is goldenrationalism.wordpress.com.
Excellent. That is cool. And hopefully we'll have you back up on the station to do some topics soon.
I hope so as well. It is my plan.
Excellent. Well, let's take a quick break, and then we are going to Jo-Lanta, or the Great Atlanta Toy Con. So we are going to be going there, and we are going to be talking all about Mego figures. We'll be back in a moment.
Welcome to the first Iconic Rock Talk Show segment on ESO. It's exciting to be here. Unfortunately, we're starting things off on a sad note, as the biggest news in the music world right now, of course, is the passing of the legendary Chuck Berry in St. Louis this past Saturday at the age of 90. Berry's influence on rock and roll, and in turn on popular culture as a whole, it's hard to almost impossible to overstate it. He didn't invent rock and roll, but he virtually single-handedly shaped what it would become. And he was deservedly the first inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And John Lennon gave us probably the best way to remember him when he said, if you tried to give rock and roll another name, you might call it Chuck Berry. Also this week, across the pond, the Kinks' Ray Davies was knighted by Prince Charles for services to the arts. Davies already was a commander of the most excellent order of the British Empire. He was bestowed with that honor in 2004. His new album is coming out April 21st, and it's entitled Americana, based on his most recent memoir, Americana, The Riff, The Road, The Story. The Jayhawks are the backing band on the album, and it will apparently include snippets of spoken word passages from the book. That book has been out a while, and I haven't read it, but I did get to see him back in the 90s on a combination spoken word concert tour supporting his first memoir, X-Ray. And you don't have to be a Kinks fan. He is such a brilliant storyteller that you just get drawn into his world, and it's fascinating. So this album should be worth checking out. He's also working on a musical based on the theme of siblings. No doubt he's going to have an interesting take on that, and his brother Dave will have an interesting take on his take. Speaking of musicals, Bat Out of Hell, the musical, opened over in Britain at the Manchester Opera House for a run before moving to London in April, and the early word from critics is that it's actually very good. Of course, it's based on the Meatloaf albums Bat Out of Hell and Bat Out of Hell 2. Most of these jukebox musicals have a really high built-in cheese factor. I'm a lifelong Queen fan, and you would think that would translate to the stage, but the storyline for their musical, which is called We Will Rock You, is just so hokey that it hasn't made it to my bucket list. So it's a little bit not reassuring that the storyline for Bat Out of Hell, the musical, is a little similar to that, and it's probably something you'd expect from a Meatloaf musical. It's described as a romantic adventure about youth and passionate love set against the backdrop of a post-cataclysmic city adrift from the mainland. But if any material can jump up to the stage from vinyl, it's going to be Jim Steinman's. So we'll have to see if it makes it to the States to take a shot at Hamilton. Marvel Comics is releasing a graphic novel this July written by will.i.am of the Black Eyed Peas. It's called Masters of the Sun, The Zombie Chronicles. And the press release describes it as mixing L.A. gang culture, b-boyism, and Egyptology. It fuses together the genres of music and comics and tells the complete tale of a retro-futuristic zombie thriller mixed with action, suspense, and horror unlike anything seen before. So, yeah, that's what you've been waiting for. A graphic novel by the guy that wrote My Humps. And something truly epic is coming out next fall. As all established artists seem to eventually do, They get around to that retrospective box set. Weird Al Yankovic, who should be writing graphic novels, is releasing his own box set called Squeeze Box, The Collected Works of Weird Al Yankovic. And it's going to come in a box shaped like an accordion. It's going to have all 14 of his studio albums, a photo book, and an extra disc of unreleased songs and non-album cuts entitled Medium Rarities. He released a trailer for Medium Rarities with little snippets of these tracks as a soundtrack for a Weird Al video, arcade video game. And you can check it out on his YouTube channel. This has been the Iconic Rock Talk Show. Check out the blog at iconicrocktalkshow.wordpress.com.
Hello, Marvel Universe! The Earth Station MCU podcast is your home for all things related to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Join our debrief as we discuss Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Agent Carter, upcoming and past favorite Marvel movies, cosplay, comics history, toys, games, interviews, and all things MCU. Whether you're a hero or a villain, a new viewer, or have been reading comics since you were a kid, there's something for you on Earth Station MCU.
You're the next contestant.
Right.
You guys
ready
to
go? Ready to go?
Somebody called Drew Pearson.
Welcome to our Mego panel. We have with us today Mr. Ricky Zero, legendary lead of Radio Cult and the Possum Kingdom Ramblers, and the man who keeps me from sounding way too bad when I sing. We have Mr. Mike Gordon and Mr. Mike Faber from the ESO podcast. And is that an ESO network?
Yes, it is.
And Mego is close to all of our hearts. We refer to it as the disco of toy manufacturers, because them boys were heavy hitters and they didn't even mean to be. They broke rules no even knew were in existence, especially them. So with no further ado, gentlemen, take it away.
Absolutely, and we thanks for coming, and we are going to be recording this for an upcoming episode of Earth Station 1, so thanks for coming out. And yeah, we're here to talk about our love for Mego figures, which is, they were dominant for a decade, right?
Yeah, for the 70s.
Pretty much the whole 70s, too, pretty much from like 71 through 81, they were pretty much, when you saw action figures and any licensed material, that's the who were the producers of them. And every kid, it was the must-get toy of the era, pretty much. And I was teasing it with my son when he was asking, what's a Mego figure? I said, it's basically the pop figures of the 70s.
That's absolutely it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a game changer, and I think we all kind of lived through that. Because, I mean, I think, I mean, I know that my first Tall was a joke with a Joe, and I was getting I got the G.I. Joe Adventure line, I got Big Jim, I got $6 Million Man, and I was getting all the, they were all like the 12-inch figures, and that's what I thought was the standard.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden, you know, come along these 8-inch figures,
right,
which don't really play well with the 12-inch.
No.
But yet they're the cool, I was a big Batman fan, and to me the Batman Mego with Batman, Robin, And the Batman had a more than uncanny resemblance to the Adam West Batman.
Yeah.
I mean, it actually had pupils, which I think like no other Batman toy had had at the time. So it really resembled the 60s show, which I love. So it had Robin, and then the Batmobile was like the 60s version of the Batmobile. So, I mean, that was really heavily influenced by that.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes you just can't get rid of a bomb.
So you guys are more the historians, and I don't want to get into a huge history because obviously anybody can just, you know, read
Google it.
Yeah, they can Google it, Wikipedia it, and all that for the exact history of it. But as far as your personal history, like when were you guys aware of Migos?
My first awareness of Mego was when G.I. Joe was going down in flames with the Bullet Man, and then into Super Joe action. You couldn't find it where I was from. There was Action Jackson. Mm-hmm. And that was really kind of a little later. That was like 74, I guess, that Action Jackson was out.
No, he originally came out before the superheroes.
Did he really?
Can I kick in a little history?
No, Absolutely. Kick it in. Rudy Panucci, ladies and gentlemen.
Yay!
Our shows are all interactive, so please jump in.
The whole reason that the world's greatest superhero line happened was that Action Jackson was a colossal failure. They had warehouses full of bodies they made, and the toys weren't selling. And Marty Abrams, who was running Mego, was panicking. He called his friend Stan Weston, who is sort of the secret father of G.I. Joe and also the father of Captain Action, and the founder of the Licensing Corporation of America. And he said, I'll tell you, you got those bodies, let's fix the mistake I made with Captain Action. Instead of making a figure that turns into superheroes, I've got the licenses for DC and Marvel and King Features and a whole bunch of other stuff.
And you got them for about $15.
Yeah, he had control at that point, and he just said, do superhero figures, make cheap costumes, and do new head sculpts and slap them on those bodies. That's why the first generation Migos are so poorly made. They started fixing the problems as they went into production of original bodies.
And to get rid of all the Action Jackson outfits, they repackaged them as superhero outfits.
Right, right.
So
they're still finding fresh warehouse stock Action Jackson figures and outfits in, you know, that you can buy. I got a set of 8 uniforms for like $5 a pop.
Wow.
Almost 50-year-old warehouse stock.
But the thing that they did that was genius was that they had those comic book ad insertions.
Yes.
And they were bright, and they were pop, and they were exciting
that was
renderings.
Another fellow, Ivan Schneider, who went to them. He was already had a deal with DC to sell their limited collector's edition comics direct using ads in their comics because they didn't have wide enough magazine distribution.
Yeah.
So he had a relationship with DC, and he's like, you got these superhero toys, let me sell those too. So he started placing ads in Marvel and DC Comics, and then he started printing his own comic book catalogs.
Yeah.
And those are produced by the first year students of the Joe Kubert School.
Yep.
I should have known. Yep. They look like first year art students.
It was crude drawing.
Now, did they ever advertise the Mego guys through the Captain Company and Warren Comics?
Well, Captain Company bought some and sold them. Captain Company was just Jim Warren.
Oh, I know. He was the biggest whoremonger on the planet. I have a fondness for shyster marketing guys. I mean, Don Levine, who was quote unquote the father of G.I. Joe. Biggest shyster marketing guy you ever met in your life, and God love him for the P.T. Barnum he was, but Jim Warren was the same guy in a different suit, man.
He
was a breed.
Mego, Star Trek, and Planet of the Apes, and he had the Power Records of those and put those in.
Oh, yeah. And Don Post Mask never would have been a thing without Jim Warren, boy, I tell you.
Yeah.
But back where I was from, I don't know how it was in West Virginia. Were you from West Virginia?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how it was there, but back where I was from, it was Western Auto was the closest thing with toys, 15 miles away. And they had those Action Jacksons. Well, I had the Action Jacksons. They were held together with rubber bands.
Mm-hmm.
And about 15 minutes after I got them, I was a crying mess. And so a few weeks later, I ended up with the Planet of the Apes guys. And that was phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
It was cheap. It barely looked like what it was. But, man, when that television show came on and you had those figures, it was like this perfect alignment of the universe that suddenly your toy was reinforced in your life, you know. And the play and imaginative value was immediately escalated, you know. And that kind of circular reinforcement had not happened really much in pop culture toy iteration, you know. So they were inadvertently genius. I don't think they sat there with a master plan and a globe in front of them going, wah-ha-ha. I think they accidentally stumbled into these major successes early on And they were like, all right, they're lighting in the bottle. Let's go. Let's grab some more.
Oh, yeah.
And they just turned it into a thing.
Well, Planet of the Apes, especially Marty Abrams had gone with his son to see a Planet of the Apes movie marathon, and his son wanted figures for the movie. That's why they're Planet of the Apes figures.
That's why I have my show is here. Daddy, I'm making a figure. All right, let's make one. Let's sell it to Joe Lennon.
For me, getting into Migos as a kid, I had them as far back as I can remember. I guess my dad thought they were cool, and so he bought them for me as a kid. And I had a handful of superheroes and Star Trek Migos.
Mm-hmm. Those were great. At Captain Kirk, they had the aliens, you know, the Klingons.
Yep. They had the Gorn.
They had the Gorn. I was about to say Gorn. I'm not good. What was that? Michael, you had it. Yes, Dave.
Yeah, the playsets that they came out with.
Oh, beautiful. That Enterprise was gorgeous.
Yeah. The
they have one in here, actually.
Playset, incredible. A friend of mine had it.
But they had multiple playsets.
Yeah. Did you remember the one that was for Star Trek that was the temple?
Yes.
And you had the glove in it that could grab the action figures?
What?
Yes. Okay. So check this out.
Mission to Gamma.
Our friend, Brian Tatum.
Yeah.
Okay. The only place I'd ever seen those playsets was really in a magazine, except with the exception of the Planet of the Apes one. So I'm over at Brian Tatum's house, and he's got this 5,000 square foot warehouse of toys, and my jaw is dragging the floor, and I happen to see that Star Trek playset.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I had never seen that as a kid, other than in a magazine. I was like, well, where did you see that? I didn't know that they even distributed it here.
No, where I grew up, they had a store called Corvettes.
Uh-huh.
And it was out in the Washington, D.C. area. They had a toy section, and a whole row was all Mego figures.
Wow.
It was the action the superheroes, then the Star Trek, then Planet of the Apes, and later Space 1999. You know,
which was not Mego.
It wasn't?
Yeah.
Wow, I did not know that. They looked just like it, but it was...
I think they had the license in Europe.
That was Palatoy did the Space 1999.
Yeah. Well, but it was interesting because they had them mixed in together. So, and as a kid, you know, it's like I don't care who makes it. I want that one. I want that one. And, you know, they had all... It was great because they had the two shelves. The shelves on the bottom were the action figures. And the one above it was where the playsets were.
Yeah.
And everything. And it was just amazing because they also, for the superheroes, I remember they had the Batcave.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They had the
Joker Mobile?
Yeah. They had the Joker Mobile, which was like a VW, right?
Yeah.
It was Volkswagen wagon.
Yeah.
I had the Batmobile. I had the Enterprise Bridge set. I wanted so desperately the Batcave, and they had the penthouse, the
Wayne
three.
Manor.
Yes. Oh, man. I used to dream about getting that.
I've seen that at Mego Bee. It's still impressive.
Oh, man. I mean, these are huge. And that's, I think, the key, too. I mean, yes, they had the licensing, but they really went out of their way to give us, like great play sets to play with as well, great accessories. And the likenesses were good enough.
They repurposed the hell out of the playsets they would make, because the Batcave was also a Planet of the Apes playset. It was just, you know...
That was the Ape City playset?
Ape City.
I'm not sure which one it was, because they had four different Planet of the Apes playsets.
Didn't they have,
Didn't
they have the...
They had the Treehouse.
The Beneath the Planet of the Apes one? Or was that the Batcave one?
I don't think that was what it was called.
But something similar. It was something similar.
There was the garage, there was the fortress,
there was the jail. The jail was a mini place.
The village and the Batcave were the same.
Oh, that's
right.
Yes, that's right.
Change the cardboard or whatever inside the vinyl.
Right.
Well, and they weren't constrained. Like Hasbro would try to keep their cardboard and vinyl places cubed.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to create too many weird angles. Man, Mego was jutting off in all kinds of directions.
Well, if you look at it, like the Enterprise bridge that they had.
Yeah.
And it had the teleporter with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where it spun it around, then you hit the button, and that's awesome. It stopped.
Oh, yeah. I think there was a little LSD going around the old
But still, it was like a really, it was a really simple and brilliant solution to how can we make a transporter.
Yeah.
And it just, like, that worked. It was a simple idea.
What was the model sets they would do with the quick change model sets where you'd spin the dial and you'd go from a time machine to a dinosaur planet where the time machine travels getting quick change. Like, come on, man. So let's do the teleporter.
Oh, yeah, but the teleporter didn't work all that well because, you know, the figure's arms would get stuck in it.
You had to make sure they were secure in there.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that never happened to Kirk on the original series. Captain's arm gets ripped off. Throw him in a transporter. Let's reassemble his ass.
Why is that with Nurse Chapel?
Well, you always wondered what happened to Yeoman Rand. Now we know.
Yeah, absolutely. But the playsets and obscure playsets. Emerald City, for God's sake, wow. Man. Come on. It was like...
Oh, the Witch's Castle.
Witch's Castle. Yeah.
The Walton's House.
Mm-hmm. The Walton's House. I've never seen one in real life. I've seen pictures.
I've heard of it, but I...
But they did great vehicles for them, too.
Really?
And the Walton's truck.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
The
country store is one of Amigo's best places.
Yeah, really? I got a John Boy Walton in a batch of stuff one time. We just took it out and shot it with a BB gun. Good night, John Boy. His mole makes a perfect target.
But I used to love the accessories, too, that came with it.
Yeah.
You know, like with the Batman one, you actually were able to take his mask off.
You were in Batarang.
The early ones, yeah.
The early ones.
Yeah, and they're removable masks.
A version you couldn't and a version you could.
Right.
Yeah. I take the mask off.
And also the gloves,
the mittens.
The mittens, as Mike was talking about earlier.
Bad mittens.
And they used to split real quickly down the seam and everything. And it's funny, like with the Star Trek ones, because they had the tricorders and the communicator the phaser.
Yeah, the phasers were
good. And it was great with the tricorder because it was a sash across the chest. It snapped just like that. And it's like, my parents' reaction to it basically was, oh, we got a cigarette lighter here. You know, like,
if we'd only had the three doodlers then.
Exactly.
We'd have been extruding plastic all over.
I like the different body styles that they started out with. You know, they had the metal joints, I guess it was, what are they called, pop rivets?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Print.
That was the second one.
Those are the ones that are left over from the Action Jackson warehouse.
Those were the second body style. There was the Type Zero.
The Type Zero, yeah.
Which was that style of body but with plastic rivets.
Yeah. Named after Ricky Zero. Yeah.
And then there was the Type One, which is what you're talking about.
The Type Zero was the one that was two. Action Jackson's because they were so fragile.
And Type Two was the plastic joints?
Yes.
Type Two was the metal.
No, Type One was metal joint. Type 2 was a completely different body with plastic joints.
Right. As they became successful, they re-engineered the figure. And I wish I would have brought Lee because he knows this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you know, breaking it down to that stuff, but how you felt about Mego, when I saw the 12-inch Megos,
mm-hmm.
It gave my heart a leap because I had given up after Joe bit the dust.
Yeah.
I mean, Joe was the
contributed to the demise of Joe.
They did in the 8-inch sense, but then when you saw the Christopher Reeve inspired 12-inch
Kiss,
man. Who in 78 didn't want the Kiss dolls, man?
Yeah,
those things.
The world's greatest superhero line that came up. That knocked the Adventure Team from the number one action figure perch.
Mm-hmm.
And
come on, we have to take responsibility with Bullet Man and Super Joe. I mean, man, we could lay it at somebody else's feet or four martini lunches at the Hasbro executive.
It was actually Hasbro panicking because $6 million man that Kenner had was killing them.
Yep.
And the world's greatest superhero line. So they're like, let's get a bionic guy, Mike Power.
Yeah.
Let's do a superhero. Oh, God, we can't get any Marvel or DC. What's in the public domain? I remember a thing called Bullet Man. Okay, go with it.
Yeah, and giving him a unitard.
Yeah.
And I will emphasize tard.
The unitard may have been a bad idea.
I think the bare-legged YMCA inspired.
I think at that point they were like, okay, we have to vacuumize the arms. Let's save money, okay?
So I can shake my fist at Mego or accept the fact that Hasbro did it to themselves, because I know Don, they did it to themselves.
Yeah.
I think that was a case where if they had given him pants and left the boots off, it may have been a step ahead. Right.
But the licensing, that was the genius part. And Hasbro was never going to go that step at that
Hasbro
point.
Hasbro was that far behind. That's why
they... Yeah, and they set a pace for licensing, influencing where toys were going.
Yeah.
And they were licensing how far back? They got the Spider-Man and Superman stuff.
Early 70s.
Like 73, probably, 72.
It's amazing, too, to think
71?
That...
71?
It's amazing. I think it's amazing to me, especially in this day and age, where you had also... And as companies, Marvel and DC were kind of lobbing at each other as competition. But yet in the toy world, they were both in bed with Mego.
Yeah, that's because they were still small potatoes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, DC...
They were handled by the same agents.
Yeah, they were, but they also didn't have the pop culture firepower that it got to after Superman the movie. That's when comics started first really gaining, you know, gravitas and the whole gig, and I don't even know what that word means. but the licensing that they set the pace for, yes, Star Wars was the biggest thing in the pop culture landscape, but I don't think that the toy insertion would have happened or occurred to George Lucas without what Mego did.
Well, actually, Mego, Marty Abrams was out of the country when 20th Century Fox called Mego and said, hey, would you like to do a toy line based on this new movie we have coming out? And the secretary said, I don't think it'd be interesting. So they went to Kenner.
And God bless her in the old poorhouse nursing home now. But it really does
really kill off Mego line.
Yeah,
and they got out of the Indians figures. They went to smaller figures that were less popular. I remember, you know, being in my late teens, and they came out with their Pocket Heroes.
Yeah,
which are horrible. They're
like, those sought after avidly.
They're very sought after, but they're built like He-Man.
Yep.
And they
were just ahead of their time then, baby. They were just ahead of their time. They set that tempo for He-Man, too, though. Yeah. You know, the interconnectivity of licensing and pop culture that got flipped on its head with G.I. Joe, Real American Hero, He-Man, She-Ra, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah.
It was these accidental kismet kind of connectivities that were happening.
And
then,
a lot of Mego's successes were just incredibly good luck, because you look at the properties they had, they were just throwing everything at the wall to see what stuck, and just a lot of stuff stuck.
Yeah,
that's true.
I mean, where do you go from Conan to the Bulls?
You have one hell of a playset. That's what I mean, Mary Ellen wouldn't be saying goodnight, John Boy, then. Hello, Conan. Waka Waka, Barbarian in the House.
And almost Dallas action figures.
Wow.
Is that why Figures Toys did those later on? Or who was it? Toy Island? Somebody did.
Figures Toy Company has been repopping mostly DC stuff, but a lot of other properties. And they've done some stuff lately that's really sort of exciting. Like, I don't know if you guys are aware of the new Batmobile copy of the original Mego Batmobile.
Mm-hmm.
They announced it in January. It's going to be out sometime this year, probably $89 or $90 or $100. And they're doing it in black and blue.
And blue, right.
And red.
Yeah, I did see that.
Wow, all
that's
the colors
weird.
Of physical violence.
Yeah.
Well, and a week later, they announced they're doing the bat cycle.
Oh,
so
wow.
So three colors. And they've done the Joker van.
No. Well, technology has given us the ability to do so many. I mean, the guys that recreate the Enterprise playset, and they do the mansions and things like that. They have the interchangeable Mego-esque backdrops playsets that they sell.
Yeah.
It's amazing, but they haven't done a tiki playset.
They have not.
Come on, and Mike Gordon. When are you going to put out the Mike Gordon tiki Wonderland?
I am purposefully in I'm presently in negotiations. So you know, we'll see.
I'm sitting in between the two guys who should be making that happen. Right.
Until I can build a tiki bar, I can't get all my worlds to collide, pal.
Now, was one of the licenses that they had? Was Mego the ones that put out the Happy Days figures?
They did.
Fonzie's thumb, like, I think that was the first time I ever had a Mego that actually something was a different point of
where
articulation.
Something went erect. Like, let me tell you about Tom of Finland.
it was a bonus point of articulation.
A bonus. Anyway, so Tom of Finland, I'm sorry, the Fonz, had a motorcycle?
Yeah.
Did he have a hot rod?
He had a motorcycle. There was a hot rod car. There was Fonzie's garage.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. I was thinking there was a bigger one. Were there pops?
No.
No?
Think of the missed opportunity because they could have taken Mel's the shark from the Aquaman set.
Arnold.
I know.
They left it up to you. And that's kind of what I guess we're talking about here. How
the guy
who combined all these.
Arnold of the Mel.
The company has reproduced the shark.
Oh, yeah? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And now you can jump the shark.
There is a reproduction of Fonzie and a reproduction of the shark. Is there a reproduction of the motorcycle?
No, he just steals it from Evil Knievel. Yeah. But I think that'd be a fun fan video for Fonzie and Evil Knievel to get together to defeat the shark.
Now, Buddy mentioned the ads from Egos in comic books, and that was one of the main things that I had just wanted to mention briefly. I was a little bit younger and didn't get a whole lot of Egos as a kid. But I did get my older brother's comic books after he moved out and read all of those ads for these wonderful Migos that you could no longer get in stores, drawn in just amazing detail.
Yes.
In full color. And I just wanted them so badly and considered sending in that, whatever it was, $1.17, just to see if they were still sending out those Green Arrows and Spider-Man action figures that I hadn't acquired before they stopped selling them in stores. So I think for me, just memories, we were talking earlier about memories of being a kid in Migos. One of my memories was of the ads in the comic books and the figures that I never did see in person until I was an adult collector, but that I just imagined, I wonder what these look like. I wish that I could get these figures. How is that for you? You mentioned, Buddy, the figures that got you into Mego were the Action Jacksons.
Yeah.
What about you guys? Which figures did you see or want?
Stuff like gum.
Well, when you were kids.
For me, it had to be all the superhero ones. You know, all the, you know, looking at them and seeing the Joker, seeing the Fantastic Four.
Were all these available in stores when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Just my parents were cheap and they never bought them for me.
There's a movie, a really bad movie called The Toy with Richard Pryor and Jackie Gleason.
Yes.
And there's a scene in a toy store and every shelf is filled with Mego product.
Yeah.
There are Mego collectors who just buy the, you know, the DVD or Blu-ray of that so they can just freeze frame it.
Yeah. No, it's because, you know, I grew up in a major metropolitan area. We had Toys R Us, but we had all the different stores. And Mego was everywhere at the stores. And especially, you know, later on, like when Micronauts came out and stuff like that, you know, all the kids had to have all the different Micronauts toys and such. Or, you know, when Black Hole came out, you know, when they had all the different, even because they were compete, we mixed them up with the Star Wars stuff. Because, you know, we were able to play the Star Wars toys fighting the Micronauts, you know, stuff like that.
It's amazing how quickly they changed the whole dimensionality of action figures.
Yeah.
You know, the 12-inch was the standard, and then all of a sudden, it was 8-inch or 6-inch. You had the Lone Ranger from Gabriel coming out, Tonto, and all that stuff, and you had numerous others. I guess Marx had been doing stuff like that years before with Johnny Apollo and Jane Apollo and the Safari stuff and the Sundowner Gang. But
you had all the other 8-inch knockoff stuff like the AHI Monsters,
LJN
Monsters,
Lion Rock.
Lion Rock, they did some of the 6-inch stuff. Military
and for
guys.
Years I swore that those monsters were Mego.
Well, that Mego had monsters as well.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, they had the Horrible Mummy and Frankenstein and Dracula and the Wolfman.
Mm-hmm. I remember the Wolfman one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but they had the knockoffs of those that were done by AHI and Lincoln.
Yeah, Lincoln. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What was the most obscure?
Generic lines of Mego figures. So they had a generic Western line, and they had mice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, all the public domain stuff. Yeah. They had Robin Hood.
The I don't want to play with your toys.
But that killer replaced it for the Viper, for the knights.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, the castle.
And
they reused it for the monsters.
Well, that
I didn't know that actually got released.
Yeah.
Wow.
It did.
So you grew up in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of toy stores there. Where did you grow up, Mike?
I grew up in Massachusetts, and I can remember distinctly, fall has always been, my time of year. I'm a November baby, but one of the things that I always loved... Yep. One of the things I've always loved about that time of year is the signaling. As bad as it is that school starts, it's not very long after that that you get the JCPenney's catalog.
Yes.
When you get the JCPenney's catalog, you go to the back, and then there's your Mego catalog. There's your, okay, this is what I want for... See, my birthday's coming up in November. My Christmas, of course, is coming up, so I get, two opportunities to see how many of these I can get.
I got a strategy.
How many of them did you go through and, circle and
stuff? Oh, yeah. I was...
To the point where you're tearing through that cheap catalog paper.
Yeah, because that paper was really thin.
It was.
It was paper thin.
Well, it was. It was.
And there was a particular smell to most of the... They all had almost a unique smell each, but there was almost a... particular smell of this catalog is that cheap printer's ink and the clay coating they put on it, and depending on how flimsy those pages were, boy, they might not survive those 3-4 weeks that they were out.
It smelled like hope.
It smelled like hope. It did smell like hope.
Remember that?
Right.
Now, I think that we would be remiss if we didn't ask at least the guy in the Mego shirt... what his memories from childhood are of Migos.
Introduce yourself.
My name is Scott Arnson.
Hey, Scott. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Scott.
And I'm an addict, sir.
And I am a Mego addict.
That's right. I've been up and down that staircase a few times. They just 12 steps.
I didn't have actually very many Migos as a kid. I think I had 14 total. And 11 heroes and 3 apes.
Yeah.
And then, when 75, 76 rolled around, I was 13. So I was kind of getting out of toys.
Mm.
And surprisingly, when I was in college, I was talking to a classmate, and this was probably 88. He said that he had just seen the Fantastic Four in Lionel Playworld here in Atlanta. They were still hanging on the cards.
Really?
I said, you're full of crap. Mego hadn't been in stores in forever. He said, no, I saw the Fantastic Four and Spider-Man. He had them as a kid, so he knew it.
And the Hulk. It was the Lionel Playworld on Buford Highway.
It was.
Ricky bought it.
So,
99 cents a piece.
I got to see this. So the next weekend I came to Atlanta and where they were. And
I'll be
I bought my, because I didn't have the Fantastic Four as a kid.
They've been on the shelf for 10 years?
I don't think I ever saw them in the store.
No.
I don't remember.
It was a warehouse deal. They put them back out. You have finally verified for me.
We've been calling him a liar for a decade.
I saw them in 1998 in the stores for 99 cents a piece. And I mean, it was like a whole display of them. It wasn't just one or two. It was a ton of them.
I had known them then when I know now, so I would bought them all.
It was just those 6 characters that I saw, the Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, and Hulk.
There was no Hulk.
When I saw them, there was Hulk, and I didn't get any of them, and they were 99 cents a piece. And a few weeks later, I was like, I got to go back there and get them. And I went back, not a single one.
I bought the Fentas, four took them home, ripped them off the cards.
Now, there you go.
I still had the Migos from my childhood and merged them together, and that's what started me collecting them.
So that's you awesome. Got back into collecting really early after stopping playing with toys.
Yeah. Which I don't have now.
That's with me. I've been a G.I. Joe collector for a long time now, and I got one of the 12-inch Hulks back into my collection, and he was just awesome. I mean, you see hyper-detailed Hulks now, and you see much better articulated Hulks, but there was so much charm to that particular Hulk. Even though you never find him with his pants, and that's a little disturbing.
And you really never find him with the white shirt.
You never find him with the white shirt. And why that boy didn't invest in spandex, I'll never know. Then immediately after that, I got the Kiss dolls, or Gene. I got Gene, and ended up with extra gauntlets, and Ricky ended up with my extra gauntlets there.
Yeah, finally finished my Kiss collection.
You did, and we... I ended up again with the 12-inch. I think I had the 12-inch Batman. Never got the 12-inch Robin. And I haven't had the ones with magnetic ends. But I think those would be great post-it note holders. You know what I mean? I just look for that, you know. So I started just hot glue gunning magnets to random action figures.
In the fridge.
Yeah, absolutely.
We used to have a Baron Karza head on our fridge.
That is so cool. I mean, Micronauts were... Did Mego carry the... Yeah. They broker the Micronauts?
Yeah.
They did.
Yeah.
I saw them in random Japanese magazines that showed these guys. And then the Michael Golden Micronauts came out by
the
Marvel.
Comic. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was just so phenomenally drawn that Mego had Michael Golden doing their ads. They never had a down moment.
Yeah. I remember the Mego ads in comics for Micronauts, and they were about as good artistically as the other of their ads.
Yeah.
Which is crazy because they had Ken Kelly doing the artwork for the packaging.
Well, that's amazing. Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, here it is. I'm reading a Micronaut comic, and I'm seeing amazing artwork in this comic, and I turn the page, and I see an ad for the figures, and I'm like, wow, look at the art on that.
Yeah, it's sort of like giving vodka in what you think is a glass of water.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
Yeah. Thing happened with Captain Action, where you're reading the Captain Action comic drawn by Wally Wood, and you get to the ad for Captain Action that's drawn by Kurt Schaefer.
But that was the work of Raphael compared to this stuff with me. But toy ads in comics were... I mean, the quality was all over the place, but they worked on the psychology of all our generation. The Mego is just one example of how much impact they had. I mean, starting with the old Andy and George ads and all the way up to the end of the golden age of comics that I mean, even Hubba Bubba looked good in those dang things.
And Superpowers figures in the mid-80s, they had ads for them in the comics. Yeah. And those looked good. Yeah. I mean, by that time, they had photographs of the toy.
Well, the thing with the Mego ads that everybody remembers, the ones that look like they're drawn left-handed, they were produced on the cheap. They weren't commissioned by Mego. They were commissioned by Heroes World. Ivan Snyder, who was selling them, the Mego stuff, through DC and Marvel.
Gotcha.
And he hired the Joe Kubert School to do the artwork.
We need to send his heirs some nasty
letters. I was going to say, that doesn't speak highly of the Kubert School. But
some of the greatest comic book artists to come out of the Kubert School worked on those, and you can embarrass the hell out of them.
Absolutely. I want a list of those names on my desk tomorrow.
Steve Bissett, Mike. Yeah, the guys who did Swamp Thing for Alan Moore wrote it. Got their start doing those ads in Mego comics.
They may have been terrible, but they made me want the toys.
They did.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we didn't need much back then, you know. I mean, obviously,
yeah.
And they had TV ads too. I do remember the TV ads for the play sets and everything like that, so that you could see them in action. But we really didn't. I mean, if you were a Spider-Man fan, a Batman fan, Planet of the Apes fan, I mean, that was your only choice anyway. But they still held up. It wasn't like you looked at them and were like, I can't recognize that. That's not you know, that's not what I want to play with. But they were, I mean, extremely playable.
Well, you even wanted the stuff that made no sense, like the Green Arrow card.
Oh, right, yes. Or even the Joker, like, VW wagon. It was like, that made no sense, but it still was cool.
It was.
And you can get reproductions of that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The advantage to Mego, the biggest advantage it had over G.I. Joe is you could sneak them into school in your pocket.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a sandbox war if everybody whipped them out at the right time.
It is strange that they, they had such a success with that 8-inch. And it was all, obviously, it was all targeted to boys. I mean, I don't think, I mean, maybe with the Walton's license, they were thinking maybe.
Well, they did Dynamite, right?
Yeah, Dynamite.
And they did, 10 iterations of that Treehouse play set with every different thing they did.
Yeah.
And it started off as a Dynamite Treehouse.
I've actually run
which I think came with a tiki bar.
That's the tiki bar. We're getting one.
Yeah. It wasn't the Dynamite, it was a beach house. It wasn't. They didn't
it was a beach house?
It was a beach house.
No, there is a Dynamite version. It was branded Dynamite.
But I do remember at the time.
But the Dynamite Treehouse, like you said.
Oh, it's the Dynamite. It's the Dynamite Beach House.
It was a beach house.
Plan A Treehouse. It's just the same house,
it's the same
different day. Century.
Yeah.
I do remember at the time, though. Whereas the 12-inch, Joes were dying. Barbie was still on fire because my sister was collecting Barbie at the time, and she had no interest in any of the Mego dolls.
You're a little short for a stormtrooper.
She was still, like all over Barbie. She was getting the places, she was getting the Camaro, the beach house, all the Barbie stuff. So, and all my guys looked like little people.
They were just stumped until Charlie's Angels came out. That band. Was a rocket. But
the advantage of being an 8-inch tall action figure when you meet a Barbie.
I do want to relate my favorite Mego memory of the last 5 years was going to Wonderfest in Louisville, Kentucky this past year. And our friend Steve Stovall, who's a dealer in this room over here, had us over to his house. And we walked in, and every Planet of the Apes playset was set up together.
Wow.
And literally an army of apes with hundreds of briar horses all mixed in.
Oh.
And it was the most staggering, game-changing presentation of a line of toys that I've ever experienced. Just my paradigm shifted in about 5 seconds because he made something that on their own, one, two, here, little playset there, not that impressive. When you walked out of that room, you wanted to go buy every Planet of the Apes, anything you could lay your hands on. And that is a testament to the power of what Mego knew was going on. They just got right in the middle of a kid's head and wormed their way right into the cerebellum. Yeah.
Well, I want to go on something that you brought up earlier, though, about going out towards a female audience, because they did have female superheroes and such.
Crazy
dolls.
Hair.
Yeah, oh yeah.
They made fashion dolls.
Yeah,
they made the entertainment fashion. Well,
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Farrah Fawcett.
They did the Farrah Fawcett, but they, with Wonder Woman, Cher, they did Supergirl, they did Batgirl.
Donnie Marie.
Isis.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yes, they did Isis.
That's
Captain
right.
Marvel fandom.
Yeah.
And we
just,
right.
You wonder why they didn't do the Leonard Skinner line. I mean, come on, man. They were already handling. Oh, well, okay.
Yeah. The Leonard Skinner plane crash.
Whose head were they trying to get into with the Captain and Tennille ones?
The Captain and Tennille ones, man, the same cats who were buying the Village People dolls. They were throwing everything at the wall. They didn't know what was going to stick. But I think the Kiss dolls were their finger was on a different pulse than anybody. Because who else was thinking about Kiss?
Kiss was one of the hugest merchandising things in the late 70s.
Yeah, I think I knew Kiss dolls were inevitable, and whoever was going to produce them was going to make a mint.
Yeah.
So it was just it was just the right place at the right time. But, those four gentlemen are made to be toys.
Yeah. I mean, Gene Simmons is a living cartoon. Baby.
Exactly.
He still is.
He does need to leave the makeup on, though, I think. He does need to leave it on.
So in 1978, if you walked down the action figure aisle of a toy store, you were seeing before Star Wars hit the shelves.
Just before.
Just before Star Wars hit the shelves, you were seeing Kiss, Wonder Woman with Linda Carter's picture on there from the TV show. You were seeing all of these superheroes. I think they still had Star Trek on the shelves.
Yes.
By that time, they also probably had the comic action heroes.
Yeah, so Chips and Happy Days.
Did they have those?
Probably.
By then? Yeah. Basically, the entire aisle of the store could have been nothing but
Mego. Yeah, which, that's the store you walked into, right?
Of course.
That's it.
And that was what was great about it, is you had that type of stuff. You know, every once in a while you saw the Kenner stuff, like the $6 Million Man stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Oscar Goldman, and, you know, all those Bionic Woman. But and then on the other side of the aisle was you also saw Barbies. You know, it was right across from it. So you had a boy section and a girl section, literally. Yeah.
The color range on them was so much more vibrant on the Mego stuff than anything else that was happening right there.
Sure.
Everything else was almost like earth tones.
Yeah.
You know, and they were the Adam West style pals that bam.
Oh yeah, you know, yeah. They took that 66 Batman look and ran with it.
They ran all the way to the bank. That's where they ran to until they ran afoul of the bank.
They were the first ones too, talking about the packaging though. They were the first ones that came out. Like, that's the first time I remember seeing, because before then I always got my dolls in boxes, like cardboard boxes that you couldn't see the figure in.
Instead,
it wasn't until like
you were a mail order kid, you just gave yourself away.
and it wasn't until, like, you know, I would go into the stores and see the Migos that were in the sort of the plastic shell
with the
cardboard behind it. Like, that was like,
and pioneered was the multiple packaging with the same figure.
Yeah.
Because they had them in boxes. My memories of Migo are the big colorful boxes,
right.
Not big, but, you know, 8-inch. Coffee style boxes with bright primary colors, and then we would go to the Kmart where they would have the same figures on the cart.
Yes.
But we'd go to Hex, which was a chain in West Virginia, and they were in boxes. And if we went to Kresge, which was on in the middle of Charleston, and then on small cards.
Really?
And that was specific because the store had requested those cards.
Right.
Yeah.
So Mego said, sure, we'll do it. We got a question from the guy behind.
Our comment, actually, it's I remember the first Mego superheroes, and they came out with Batman, Robin, Superman, Aquaman, and I remember seeing them in the stores, and I remember distinctly that first run, because I ran to the store when I saw a classmate have them at recess. I ran to the store, and they were actually encased. There were no window.
Yeah, solid box.
They were solid box.
Yeah, solid box, right?
And I went back because I got Batman. I went back to get Robin, and I got Robin. But I noticed that most of the boxes were opened because the kids would open them to see what the figures were.
To see what the
figures. Hey, that must be why. Later on, they did the window.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, it was. I mean, yeah. We wanted to see what we were getting.
And Mego was more than willing to show all the kids, hey, this is what you can get for 99 cents.
Exactly.
And of course, you know, you're getting near the end, so you should mention that almost everything's being reproduced.
Yeah, yes. Plus, I mean, there's a
toy company and Diamond Select with Paul Clark, Doc Mego is doing Marvel figures, which we can thank Hasbro for the high price.
Now, how much of a difference between Mego size and the 112 collective is there? It's just like,
Well, the 112 collective is 6 inches.
Right.
8 inches.
8 inches. So just a little bit smaller. But the 112 collective stuff is sort of like,
it's mind blowing.
It is mind blowing. It's like Mego through the filter.
I was just about to say, I think, you know, I mean, as beautiful and as gorgeous as they are, I think the stuff that Mezco is doing with the 112, I think they to me remind me in my head of what I was playing with when I was playing with Mego.
Exactly. When you're looking back on the memory, you're adding all the years of detail you've come to expect for the money.
They're kind of about the same size, you know, they, you know, to me, and that's what, and they've got the fabric.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just, I mean, as good as the Star Wars figures were later on that we would get, it was all plastic. you know. But these were like, you know, there was actually fabric to them. You could, you know, they had more points of articulation. You could pose them better. You could swap costumes with some of them. It was just, you know, there was more flexibility with your toys.
Right, right. So, I think that we're going to see amazing stuff in the next 3-4 years from people of our generation that are trying to recreate something, but they're going to see it more along those lines. You're going to see cats going that direction, hyper detail, new materials, new art, and you're going to see it in weird, weird ways. And I'm hoping the weirder the better. I want chaos to rule the day. And so it could be some really fun stuff. I mean, I love what DC has done with the Hanna-Barbera properties. The comics and stuff.
Yeah, the comics.
That level of weirdness.
Have you seen the Figures Toy Company Hanna-Barbera sets?
I have not. I have
they
not.
They have Scooby-Doo. They've done Johnny Quest. It came out just before the end of last year. They've done the Scooby Gang, but they've got Scooby-Doo coming out later because he's got to be sculpted differently. These are all Amigo bodies.
Yeah.
And
I didn't.
They've done so many. They've got the license for the monkeys.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they're doing those 8-inch and 12-inch.
All 8 people that will buy them and appreciate
them. And if you're a fan of, and like my first love, which is Batman 66,
yeah.
They have almost every character now that was on that
Figure
series.
Toys?
In Mego size, as Mego,
wow.
Packaging, looking like Mego.
I got to pull my head out of the ground.
They are gorgeous. Everything from like Bookworm to Egghead to Commissioner Gordon. I got everybody.
So the website, just go to the website and you just start planning your bankruptcy.
It's just amazing because you could spend $1 zillion doing it now, relive your childhood pretty much.
And then some.
Yeah.
Yep.
And
absolutely.
That's cool.
They have special deals. If you spend $500, you get a free $50 book.
Right? I should start one of those deals myself. Spend $500 with me. Wait till you see what you get.
Spend $500, you get a free catalog. So you can,
that's right.
See what else
that's
you can
right. No, I got a Craigslist deal. Well, I think that's almost
that's
all
it.
Time we got.
That's
so
awesome. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, guys. Mike and Mike and Ricky Zero, and they can catch you guys regularly on
ESOPodcast.com.
ESOPodcast.com. You can catch Ricky Zero regularly.
RadioCult.com.
RadioCult.com and my house most Wednesday nights. And reach out to these guys. If this is stuff that interests you, if you dig it, let them know what you think. Check out these podcasts because podcasts survive because people listen to them and, more importantly, like and subscribe to them.
Yes.
It's the lifeblood of the podcast.
Thank you, sir.
So please do that because it's a great podcast that reflects a lot of what, if you're here, it's your kind of gig. And tune in, now you know them, you're pals.
Exactly. Well,
come, absolutely.
Thank you, guys.
Visit your radio pals.
Angela, and this week, this geek girl is talking about getting ready for conventions. Now, it's convention season, and everyone is gearing up to go to different cons all throughout the next few months. So I figured I would talk about ways I like to be ready to attend a con. First off, for packing, I like to make lots and lots of lists of everything I need to have with me. And as I pack, I mark those items off. It helps me remember all I need for the con and keeps me from having to spend extra money on stuff once I get to the con. Since if you forget your toothbrush, chances are you'll have to go buy a new one because who doesn't want to not brush their teeth for the next 4 days? And you could also be spending that money at the con. I generally make a costume checklist and a packing checklist so I have all my bases covered. And I do my costume checklist by costume so I have every item I need for that costume on it so I remember everything. Now, I also like to look at the schedule before I go to the convention. It helps me plan my days out. I like to be flexible, but I also like to know what's going on at the con and what I may be doing during the day so I don't miss the stuff that I want to do. Checking the con schedule early on their webpage helps you be able to see the guests that you want to see and attend the panels that you want to go to. And it makes it so you actually get to do stuff at the con instead of just aimlessly walking around the hallways. There are so many other things that I could add to this, but for now I'll leave it at those two items. So hopefully I'll get to see you guys at some upcoming cons in the next few months. Thanks for listening to A Geek Girl's Take. What will I talk about next week? Well, you're going to have to listen to find out.
Welcome back. Now it's time for the ESO Con Report.
Last weekend was the Huntsville Comic and Pop Culture Expo, and our occasional host, Lacey, was there, and Lacey is back to tell us all about it. Welcome back to the station, Lacey.
Hello, hello, hello. Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. So you now this is it the first year for this convention or?
No, this was the second year.
Second year. Okay.
Yeah. The first year was one day, and it was about, they had about 1700 people, and they, you know, they were not expecting that many, of course. So the lines were just out the door and out around the block and everything. So this year they went to the Von Braun Center, and they had about 3,500 attendees this year, which was pretty cool. Doubled last year and made it a 2-day event, and it was fantastic. They had, this was their first year for actual guests, for special guests. They had Chris Claremont, who did a lot of X-Men. Well, you know.
Yes, yes.
And then they had Mike Grell, who's done, among other things, he was he wrote on drew the Arrow, Green Arrow, for quite a while, and then as far as like pop culture guests, they had Joey Fatone from NSYNC and David Yost, who was the original Blue Power Rangers in the 90s. So that was really cool. And they had a lot of really good booths, and it was all of pop culture this year, as opposed to last year that was just comics. I mean, last year was like pretty much a straight up book con. But this year they had artists and, you know, creators and all kinds of folks. So it was really cool. They even had a giant room specifically for kids. They did like face painting, and it's kind of the quintessential, it's like the definition of a family con.
Very nice.
Yeah, it was really good. Matter of fact, the guy who started it, his name's Jeremy Long, and he runs it with his wife, Emily, his parents, and his brother and sister and his nephew. Like, they're the people who, it is a family run con.
Wow. That's good.
Yeah, everybody has their specific, you know, his wife is a graphic designer, so she designed all the signage and the banners and the logo and stuff. And his mom was one of the handlers for, she was a handler for David the Yost. And, you know, his sister is Jen Breland, who runs the Dragon Con charity auction and charity events.
Yep, we've had Jen on the show before.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, a lot of information there as far as, you know, being well-versed in the Comic-Con and the Dragon-Con world. So it was really cool. I won a Kindle Fire in a blind box drawing at a booth for the Pop Culture Philosophers. Had a charity booth there to do,
Congratulations.
I know. It was really, and it was like 30 minutes into the convention. It was on the first day that I was there. I was like, I'll give it a shot. And I won one of the Kindle Fires. So that was cool. And, they had a silent auction, for charity. And I got the highest bid on a screen used animation cell from the 1992 X-Men series of Beast. And of course, you know, you just can't find those very often these days. So that was kind of cool. The auction actually raised about $1,300, and they had the Mandalorian mercs there putting people in jail and you know, charging them to get out. They made about $300, and then Sylvester Photography was doing fantasy photography, and they donated their money, and that was like about $300. And then the con itself, I don't know if he does a percentage of the door or if he just does a flat donation or whatever, but so far they're right at about $2,000, and I think it's going to definitely help out for their charity that he supports. It's called Kids to Love, and they do they help with foster kids in the Huntsville area. So it's very localized, and, you know, helps the community at large. So
that's always great. That's always great to hear. And, you know, Mike and I are familiar with a couple conventions in the Huntsville area too, and I've been to even though it's not in Huntsville, but in Birmingham, Alabama, there used to be a pretty good convention called the Alabama Phoenix Fest. So I do know that in Alabama, they do put on some pretty good conventions, and the people there really go crazy for them. They really like, you know, the local cons, and they really like supporting them.
Yeah. It was pretty cool. And I know you talked, we were talking about Con K last week.
Yep.
Or the other day. Basically, I actually got to meet Bonnie and Laura while I was there. They
nice
had
people.
A yeah. Oh yeah, they were great. They run Con K, and
yep.
They bring their TARDIS, and they had all the, you know, the Doctor Who, you know, paraphernalia and stuff, and they were promoting their con. And it turns out that apparently Bonnie is really interested in kind of fostering the growth of the geek community. And so a couple of years ago, she had made an announcement at Con K saying, if anybody is interested in starting your own con, please let me know. I'm totally open for, you know, ask me questions. I'll help you out. And, you know, let me know if you have any questions. And so, Jeremy, said, you know, yeah, I want to do this. And so they started asking, you know, what's and how's and things like that. And he got some suggestions from them. And then, this year they had a booth at his con, and they saw some of the things that he was doing, and they were like, you know, I think we're going to do that at our con next year. So, it's kind of a back and forth, you know, some cross promotion and some, you know, the ideas are kind of flying. So it should, yeah, it's pretty cool.
I do like seeing that. You know, too often we hear their stories about, you know, this convention is really competitive and doesn't get along with this convention, and they have to fight for dates, or they're trying to steal guests, et cetera, et cetera. But,
right.
You know, it's really great to hear when local conventions are working together, because, mm-hmm. I mean, there's enough geekdom to go around, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
I think so. So highlights for you personally, I know, I mean, I saw the pictures of you and Joey, so I know that must have been a pretty big highlight for you.
Yes, I adore Joey Fatone, and he was hilarious and funny, and, you know, I got to chat with him in his booth a little bit, and of course, I had volunteered, I had driven over from Atlanta, and volunteered just for the whole weekend, and so, I had a little bit more access, you know, just to sort of chat with him here and there, and then I went to his panel. He was really funny. He was, there were kids in the panel asking questions about, you know, like, how did it feel when you were on stage in front of all those people? And he handles children really well, and he had really good stories about, you know, NSYNC. And at one point, I think the best question that was asked was something along the lines of, if NSYNC and the Backstreet Boys were rival news teams and you fought in a park, who would win? Like Anchorman. And he just cracked up, and he was like, hands down. And then he like went through each member of Backstreet Boys as to like who would fight and who would run and who would, and then like, you know, oh no, he would take off. He wouldn't even, you know, and it was really funny. So, but yeah, so he had some really good stories about everything from the music days to the to acting to Dancing with the Stars, and you know, some of his like reality stuff that he's doing, and then yeah, so he had a really good panel. He had a really good panel this year. So and he was like, at the end of it, he and like all the guests were like, if you want us back, we're in. This was a great con. This was really, you know, it was a good number of people. It was steady flow, but not overwhelming. And it, you know, there was plenty of time to have actual conversations with each person at the tables, which is nice. I mean, you know, some cons you go to have gotten so big that you get, you know, 15 seconds and an autograph, and you're just sort of shuffled off, you know, to the side. And,
yep.
And, this was a very, you know, it was a very personalized con. So, and they're all, and most of the vendors that I was just chatting up as I walked around were like, yeah, we were here last year. It was the first year, and we're, you know, super excited, and we're planning on coming every year. They'll have us back. And so, there's a good start for their loyalty base, I think.
Very good. Did it seem to grow then from last year?
It did. It was about triple the amount of space this year. So there were a lot more vendors, which is good, but that also gave them the room to have the guests. They had panel rooms. They had a photo op room. They had a giant game room where they actually had an arcade company come through. Well, I don't know if it was an arcade company, but they had like the big stand-up games, and they had people doing, you know, all kinds of gaming in one of the upstairs rooms. They had a whole hallway of fan tables of, you know, people who were promoting other cons and stuff like that. The 501st was there. The Mandalorian Mercs were there. I know I'm forgetting people. I mean, there were just there were some very high, not high class, high visibility folks. The people that you see, you know, at the larger cons were also there. So it was pretty cool, you know, to see the 501st show up and you know, have a presence and stuff like that. So,
well, speaking of that, how's the cosplay scene there?
There is actually pretty good. There were, I don't know that it wasn't promoted as like a big cosplay event, but they did have a huge cosplay contest. They had a contest on the Saturday, and it was about, I want to say, from noon until 3, they had like a line all the way across the second floor out the door where they were taking all their photos of all the, and then going in and talking to the judges and stuff. And then they had the, at about 3:30, everybody met at the main stage to do the, you know, like the top X number. I wasn't really a part of that because I was actually running the silent auction at that point, and the silent auction ended at 4. So I was actually had to like run to the other side of the building and make sure that the silent auction, everyone was getting their bids back in at the last minute. So I didn't actually get to see the costume contest, but the people that I saw walking around had some really cool stuff. My favorite, I think, was the Snape Ghostbuster, and it was fantastic. He was Defense Against the Dark Arts Ghostbuster.
Okay.
And it was really cool, and he was I don't know. I'm sure Jen has a photograph of him on her Facebook page, but it was absolutely fantastic. So, well, yeah.
It sounds like it had a little bit of everything. So, very good.
Yeah, it really did. It really did, yeah.
And definitely encouraging. Have they already announced dates for next year? Or?
I think he's actually going to try and get the same weekend for next year. I think they're talking to, you know, because it's the Von Braun Center is a large convention center. So, you know, you get your book your dates in as soon as you know what they're going to be. So I think he's going for the same weekend next year. And that way it doesn't conflict with any of the other ones that are in that area.
Right.
So, yeah, but it's from what I understand, it's usually this weekend or the weekend before or after, I think, from last year. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But, yeah.
Well, we'll definitely keep an eye out for it, and we'll have a link to it again so that people can check it out. And of course, you've got pictures. I understand that you are uploading more soon so that people can check out your personal journey there.
Yeah. I just sat down and got all my pictures of all my swag that I got and all my, you know, my winnings from the
right.
Yeah, from the auction. You know, it's the thing is that when you work the silent auction, you just see all the stuff, and you're like, ooh, and because I'm standing there, I'm seeing the bids go up, and I know that, like, I just, you know, so I'm standing there and like someone will bid, and then I'll go back and just bid right after them and wait, because, you know, you got to stand. There were several items. It was really fun. There were several items where, like, there were two or three people standing there, and it was like one person would write their name, and then the next person would like grab the pen. And at one point, one guy and one girl were arguing over one, or not arguing, but bidding on one thing. And it was like, she'd write down and then she'd just hand him the pen, and then he'd write down and then he'd just hand it back to her. And it was like, okay, guys. So, and it was
that's
always
pretty, that's pretty exciting fun when that happens. So,
yeah, I mean, it was pretty cool.
That's cool. That's what it's all about. Yeah. Well, very cool. Well, I'm glad you had a good time. What's your next show?
Next weekend, I think
next
I'll be joining,
weekend, right?
Yeah, I'm joining you fellas in South Carolina.
We are going to have a blast.
I can't wait.
South Carolina Comic Con is one of our favorite shows to do. Mike can attest; he's been there 2 years in a row, I believe.
Yes, sir. And this will be year number 3, and I can't wait.
This will be year number 3 for me because I was there the first year, but then I had to skip last year. So I'm very excited to return. So we're very, very excited. Are you excited for anything in particular at the show this weekend?
I am excited because this will be my first official Comic-Con Association Comic-Con. I've never been to a Comic-Con before.
Gotcha. So yeah, this show is focused mainly on comics. There are some pop culture events, guests there as well. No boy band singers, I'm afraid, though.
Right, but I believe they've got Paulie McGillion. Paul McGillion is going to be there, right?
Yes, I believe he is going to be there.
He is one of my favorite people from Dragon Con. Anytime he's there, he always does the Dragon Con charity auction. So, and he is just fantastic, and he's really good with the crowd interaction and fan interaction and stuff like that. So, that should be pretty fun if he has any panels and stuff. Yeah.
Yep, and my understanding is that you will be at spending some time at the ESO table.
Yes, absolutely. I will swing by and hang out and chat and such.
Which will be table number, for those people out there, it's table number 525 is where ESO is going to be located. So you can find Mike Faber and Lacey there. I will actually be with Peter Cutler. We'll be hawking our little Tiki Zombie books and whatnot. We will be over at a different table. We're in the 300s. Let me see if I can get it real quick. Yes, we'll be at table number 318. So, cool. So we'll be separated a little bit, but it's a smaller show. So we'll be able to see each other and hang out.
We can, right on. We'll be able to throw things at him. It's cool.
Yeah. So many friends of the station are going to be there. We're so excited to meet up with everybody again, both on either side of the table. We got a lot of friends of the station that are going to go there as attendees, a lot of people with tables that are going to be hawking their books and stuff like that. So it's just a fun event. And again, like you said with the Alabama one, it is very family friendly. So we look forward to seeing everybody there. So including, I look forward to, because I don't think we've actually like really met before. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah. I see your photos on your, on the Skype and stuff, but we've never really had a face-to-face handshake. So
that's going to be fun. So I'm looking forward to that as well. So well, cool. Well, we'll see you and hopefully everybody else next weekend.
All right. Sounds good.
And South Carolina Comic Con this weekend is not the only convention that you can find ESO people at. This weekend, March 24th through the 26th in Baltimore, Maryland, is Regeneration Who. And that is a convention, you guessed it, all focused on Doctor Who. And it's one of the better shows up there in the Northeast. And our geek girl, Angela Pritchett, who has a Doctor Who themed cookbook, and she also does a lot of cosplay. She's going to be up there as a guest, so we're pretty excited to have her represent herself as well as ESO. So say howdy to her. And then those are the only two shows left for March, because April's right around the corner. So you can find ESO people at the following events in April. The 13th through the 16th is Frolicon, and that is in downtown Atlanta, Georgia. I believe it's at the Sheridan, and Mike Faber will be at that show.
Don't tell my mom.
I was going to say, who knows who's going to be at this event? A lot of people are in masks, so it's hard to tell.
Mom, you're there.
Exactly. And then the following weekend, actually, is it the following? It might be two weekends, actually, now that I think about it. I can't do math. April 28th through the 29th is Treklanta. That is in Atlanta, Georgia as well. Mike and I will be there representing Earth Station One. We will actually be hosting a panel on Saturday afternoon. That panel is about what we learned from Star Trek. And in addition to telling you what we've learned from 50 years of Star Trek, we will also want to encourage people to come out and tell us what they have learned, what Star Trek has meant to them, and both in a fun way as well as maybe serious way, what Star Trek has sort of meant to them and what they've brought to their lives. So it should be a fun panel, and we're going to be recording that for a live episode. So if you've ever wanted to be on Earth Station One, like Lacey, you can come to Treklanta and speak out. Also that weekend, April 28th through the 30th, is RavenCon. That is in Williamsburg, Virginia. Angela Pritchett will be at that show as well. And then May, the first weekend of May, May 5th through the 7th, is Wholanta. This is a convention that's changed its name and it's changed its dates. It used to be known as Timegate, and it used to be Memorial Day weekend. But they've changed things around a little bit. It's now focused more on Doctor Who. Obviously, Wholanta definitely brings the Doctor Who element to the forefront. There will be talking about other British shows. And yes, they will mention Timegate from time to time as well. I'm sorry, with Stargate from time to time as well. And look, it's one of our favorite shows. It might be changing its name. It might be moving. It's still going to be at the same hotel. So it's still at the Marriott Century Center. And we're still going to be a good time. Mike, myself, Jennifer Hartshorn from Earth Station Who, and actually former host of Earth Station Who, former co-host, Phantom Troublemaker, will be there as well. He will be bringing his Dirty Dirty Con Con Game Game Show to Wholanta, so that should be interesting. And then also Angela Pritchett will be a guest there as well. So since she's touring the Northeast, it'll be nice for her to come down here and spend some time with us. She's been on a lot of panels with us, and I think we're going to try to work on having her on our panel as well. But we'll be doing a panel. Is it on Saturday? That's correct. Saturday afternoon, right, Mike?
Yes, sir. Saturday afternoon at 3 p.m. But like all cons, that could change.
Yes, right. It is subject to change. And sort of like we are doing with the show at Treklanta, we're actually theming our talk on what Doctor Who has taught us, what people have learned from Doctor Who. Again, over 50-year franchise, a lot of people have taken a lot of stuff from these shows, these stories. So it's been inspiring, and they've kind of taught us some practical things too. So, and maybe some things that are not so practical. So it's going to be really fun. We want everybody to come out. Again, we're going to be recording it for an episode of Earth Station Who. So if you've ever wanted to be on that show, please come out and speak and let us know what Who has taught you. So those are all the immediate events coming up. So definitely want to hear from you guys. If there's a show that you went to and you just loved, you just had a great experience like Lacey did in Huntsville, please contact us because we love talking about conventions.
So that's going to wrap up another episode of the ESO podcast. I just wanted to thank everyone who did come out with Toy Lanta, Joe Lanta, whatever they're feeling like calling it. Martin and gang put on an amazing show. Folks, if you ever get a chance to go to the show, it is worth it beyond belief. It's nostalgia to your childhood's nth degree. And, you know, you could just see things that, you know, you remember from a kid. They even had Fisher-Price toys there, I noticed, at one of the setups. And it was great to see. So it's just not all G.I. Joe anymore, hence the name of the change to Toylanta. And, of course, Mike, we made it. It was awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely one of my favorite shows to do. We've already got an idea of what our panel is going to be next year. And I think anybody who listens to even this episode is going to kind of figure out what it might be. And look, it's a, you know, I can't say this enough. It's just a great show. I mean, you get to see, you get to reconnect with your childhood. You know, you get to see actual toys that you may or may have, you may have had, or you may have played, might have played with, or you might have wanted all your life, and, or things that you haven't thought about in decades, depending on how old you are. And it just, it makes you flash back. Plus, you know, there's new toys there too. And the way that people are customizing them and throwing them down the lobby of the Marriott. I mean, it's, you feel like a kid again. It's a really good natured show. It's getting bigger and bigger every year. And, I can't thank, the folks enough that run it, Buddy and Martin and Jack and all the people that support the show. And it's just that we've gotten to know. It's just a really fun show to go to. And I'm glad it's so close that we don't have to travel very far for it.
Oh, definitely. Most definitely. And, you know, for great cons like that, you know, Atlanta's a great scene for that kind of stuff. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. And it's absolutely worth traveling to. I mean, if you are interested in the toy scene at all, it's one that definitely should be on your radar. So it's worth traveling for, I think.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. Anything you're going to shout out about, sir?
I do. Kind of on that same wavelength. I think I mentioned it a couple of weeks ago, but the Possum Kingdom Ramblers, who performed, by the way, at Toylanta, they are, their new CD is out. It's called Heroes in a Trash Can. And beautiful artwork by Jazz Ingram, sports the front and the back. And it's a great CD. I definitely encourage people to check it out. We will have a link. You can buy it online. So we'll have a link to that in our show notes so that people can check it out. But a great band. And like I said, it's a great, I like to put, ever since then, I've had a song, Space Cat, in my head all the time. It's very catchy and it's very popular. There were a lot of people chanting for it at the show. So I think if people get it, they will have to come with a warning that this song is contagious. It does cause earworms. You are going to get it in your head, and it's going to be difficult to remove. But fortunately, it's a cute, fun song, so it's good for you.
That is awesome. It's great. And, you know, they are so talented with what they do. You name a song, and they'll play it for you. They just,
yeah,
they're just great.
That, they were doing that all night. One of the things that Radio Cult does when they play at Toyland on Saturday night is they have sort of an open mic, and anybody who wants to jam with them can come down and name a song or two. And I've seen them stumped a couple times, but usually they can make do and they can get through it. And it's really a fun night. So yeah, they're talented people. I wish them much love and support. So go out and buy the CD.
Exactly. Fantastic. My shout out real quick goes out to Netflix series Iron Fist. I've actually watched the first three episodes last night. Didn't do like Mike Gordon did and watch it all the way through at one sitting.
So tired.
So, but I am enjoying it. I don't know where these haters are getting from. You know, yeah, the main character's not Asian. He wasn't Asian in the comic books, kids. It's Danny Rand is not a Asian character, and people are griping about it for the series. And Marvel is trying to be true to the comic in a lot of ways. So, you know, I don't see where people are saying it's horrible. It's a lot better than a lot of other things on Netflix or regular TV, even superhero genre stuff. And I've really enjoyed it so far. And Mike could probably tell me, you know, what's to come, but he doesn't like spoiling things.
I don't. I will say that I enjoyed it as well. I think that the pace is slow. So for some people who are not, don't like, you know, slow, but I can tell you that, for the most part, everything pays off. So if you stick with it, you shouldn't be disappointed because some stuff is really cool coming towards the end. But I think it's, you know, to me, the test is, would I continue watching this if it wasn't a Marvel property, if it wasn't tied into the Defenders? And the answer for Iron Fist is yes, I definitely would. If they announced a second season, I would be binge watching it tonight if I could. So
that is awesome. But hey, you're talking about comics and geeky stuff and Mego figures. So what can you say? But once again, next week, we are going to be returning with our new segment, the ESO Book Club, where we are going to gather and we are going to be talking about the classic now. God, I can't believe it's a classic already because it's almost, you ready for this, Mike? Almost 30 years old.
Whew.
We're talking about Mouse by Art Spiegelman. We're going to be reviewing books 1 and 2. And it is just a true classic because stuff about the Holocaust, you know, during World War II, was never really represented in comics. And the way Spiegelman got through with it was just truly amazing. So we will talk all about it. And we got already a great crew lined up for it. And, you know, I am very much looking forward to this. Of course, we want to hear from you guys at home, esopodcast@gmail.com, or call us at 404-963-9057. And, you know, tell us, you know, if you made it to Jolanta and saw us there, you know, did you like the Possum Kingdom Ramblers? Did you like our panel? Did you just get some really cool toys? You know, William went for his first time and he was in heaven for quite some time. So it was pretty cool, much a really wonderful time all the way around. But like we said, we will see you again next week here on Earth Station 1. Peace. And we're done.
You've been listening to Earth Station 1, a weekly podcast that explores the many worlds of all things geek. Please write us at esopodcast@gmail.com or call us at 404-963-9057. And if we find what you say interesting, we'll put it up on the air.
If you've enjoyed our show, please rate us or leave feedback for us up on iTunes. And while you're there, subscribe to our show or any of the ESO Network podcasts. We can also be found up on Stitcher Radio or wherever fine podcasts are found. ESO is also available up on most social media sites like Facebook, Twitter, and so many more. The show is brought to you by the fine folks at the ESO Amazon.com eStore, where right from our website you can find all kind of geeky goodness. And if you get something up there, you also help support the station. ESO also has a Zazzle store to buy cool ESO merchandise and such. Show your ESO love with something from Zazzle. To learn more about ESO, our website is esopodcast.com. The show is produced by Calico Productions. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you here next time on the Earth Station 1 podcast. Peace.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.